Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Car Chat Podcast. I'm Sam Moores, and with me today, I have Ollie Marriage. Hello.
Hey, Sam. How are you doing?
Very good, very good. Welcome to the podcast. Can you tell the audience just like a little bit about sort of who you are, what you do?
So I'm a motoring journalist, but I think that I have the greatest job title that anyone gets. I'm the head of car testing at Top Gear. So I'm responsible for the car output and stuff across Top Gear's portfolios.
Yes. Okay, let's sort of wind back a little bit. How did you sort of start out and get into this industry and end up where you are?
A long time ago, because I'm old. I got into it through a route which I don't think is as recognised now as it was then, but it was the way that everyone got into the industry back then, which was through work experience. I'd loved cars, loved writing, and it was only about when I left university that I worked out that this is something that people did for a job. Yeah. And I thought that would sound like a very good job to have. So I wrote to car magazines for work experience and got taken on by Haymarket initially, I was doing work experience on What Car magazine.
Okay.
Initially. Which was just, all I wanted to do. But in that office, that big open plan office they had in Twickenham, they were based, Teddington, were all these people whose words I'd written or read for years and years. So I was just, it was just a fascinating environment to be in.
And what were you studying something related to that at all before?
I think I was what my parents would probably term a concern to them because I'd done geography and politics at university and then sloped off and worked abroad for a year or two because I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it was one night I was in a bar with some mates talking about what jobs we were going to get when we went back to the UK, because I'd spent summers putting up marquees and generally dossing around.
Yeah.
And it was one of those nights where you suddenly go, click, something hit me, and I thought, right, that's what I want to do. So when I got back, I'd been working in the French Alps for a couple of years.
Nice.
Went back and wrote letters, as you did back then, rather than emails.
Were you skiing?
Yes. Yeah.
I spent a couple of seasons in the Alps of various sorts and New Zealand and stuff. I was an instructor for a bit.
Fantastic. That was me. And to be fair, my colleagues used to take the mick out of me because pretty much any year's annual holiday is usually wiped out by the end of March. So I've been off to the mountains again.
Yeah. So yeah. You're applying, and were you into sort of writing at that point in time?
I don't think I realised it, but yes, I was. I'd written for sort of school and university magazines and things, and quite enjoyed that. And I did sort of have a small taste of motoring journalism when I was at university, because I was involved in the university magazine. Mm. And as part of that, I wanted to do stuff with cars. And so I had been to car dealerships and tried to borrow cars and write about them for the university magazine. But funnily enough, university students aren't really interested in buying new cars from dealerships.
How did that pan out?
Well, it worked once or twice, but mainly it was, I think I can't remember how we did it, but even then it hadn't really occurred to me that to make this jump from dicking about on a student to actually doing it as a proper job.
Yeah. And then, so you ended up at What Car?
Mm. And work experience at What Car. Yeah.
And back then, when sort of was this?
This was mid late 90s.
And
so 25 years ago.
Did they immediately go, yeah, you can jump in a Lambo and review that?
No, absolutely not. So what I was doing initially, I wasn't even on What Car. I was on, they did something called The Book, which was a used car price guide, which was like a data thing, like the Cat Black book or whatever. And I was doing literally filling data into spreadsheets. It was tedious as anything, but I was in the right room while people were talking cars. Yeah. And I just thought, oh, this is amazing. Everyone around me is into this, into the same sort of things that I'm into. So the atmosphere for me was brilliant. So getting, just having that exposure and that immersion in that environment was what really excited me.
Yeah. And presumably collecting loads of random data. As you're putting it in, you're like, yes, the so-and-so weighs 1,427 kilos.
Well, no, I have been a car data geek for my entire life. If you speak to most of my friends, they will still remind you of various Top Trumps debacles where I've been able to recite the entire pack off the top of my head.
Is that something that still sticks today? I used to be like that, and I'm much so less so now.
Within the office now, I'm not. I've probably moved on and got over it slightly. But you get, I still feel torn in that way between the data of the cars and the sort of more heart-driven excitement of them.
Yeah, and then because I find if I'm driving a car, and I don't know whether you feel like this, I look at all the data beforehand. Okay, not like all the data, but as in the basic stuff. And I make a sort of assumption of what it's going to be like. And often it sort of aligns.
Tallies.
Do you find that though?
I think I do, but mainly because I've been doing this for so long now. You start working out, okay, well, if that car manufacturer's done that product, what platform it's been based on, who's it? So you know where things are coming from and how things are going because of the realities of them running a car company in the modern era for how long, for where everything's going to fit in and how they've done it for the cost and all the rest of it.
Can you think of any sort of outliers in that? Something you've got in and you've gone, I think it's going to be like this. And it's like completely different or different.
There must have been surprises over the years, but I'm terrible at recounting things or memorizing things off the top of my head. I think, there was the lovely story when I think the rumor was that Volkswagen heard that Renault was doing a Clio 3-liter car, and they thought that referred to 3 liters per 100 kilometers. So they rushed out this Lupo 3-liter that could do, I think, whatever the calculation was, 90 miles to the gallon. And of course, it wasn't a 3-liter to the 100 kilometers car. It was the mid-engine Clio V6. And I think things like that always come as like, you what?
Yeah.
What on earth made you think that was a good idea? Or, those are the fascinating cars, aren't they? That
the quirky,
seem to have
weird
come out
ones
from a little bit of a scramble somewhere. where someone's gone, well, we could try this. And then they end up, yeah, being the ones we all remember, probably.
Yeah, massively. That was a car. I got to drive one for the first time a couple of years ago. And I remember...
Gen 1 or Gen 2?
I don't know. I'm not sure, actually. No. Big wide body thing.
Yeah, yeah. They did a Gen... The Gen 1 had the sort of round headlights and was sort of more bulbous. The Gen 2, they were sort of... Was 2005 onwards?
That sounds about right.
2005 onwards. And was actually a much, much better car than the original one.
Yeah, I think that was one of those ones that I wasn't massively, like, nerdy on cars when I was younger. And I remember seeing one of those, like, just at an event and being like, what on earth is that? So it's quite a funny one to sort of look back. So you did some work experience at what car, and then how did you move on from there?
Basically, Steve Cropley, who is a name that will be familiar to everyone, came across the office one day and said they'd heard good things about me and would I be interested in a job? And up to that point, I'd spent, I think this was 2 months in, and I'd literally just been data inputting and occasionally helping out on a photo shoot or something, which had been enough to convince me this is all I wanted to do, really. And then when Steve came across the office and said he'd heard good things and would I be interested, I was like, absolutely. And then he did something that I thought was, well, this isn't road testing. I'm not quite sure about this, which was I think when I first started out on Autocar, it was editorial assistant is the job title. It sort of means dog's body, but it's a very important role to do, though, because you do everything. You get involved in everything. And so for the first few months, I think I was just subbing. I was subbing other people's copy to flow it into the magazine, doing headlines, doing this sort of thing, all with someone sitting over my shoulder watching. But you get immersed in things very quickly. And it was that, and then the combination of being able to go out on more photo shoots and drives and things that you sort of spin up into getting a bit more experience as you go along.
Yeah, and back then with the driving, like, was there a sort of education program as such, as in like trying to get people to be better drivers / able to do more stuff?
Yes, there was. I think once I was on staff, we got sent on various driving courses to do bits, but I still maintain that all of us who came through the sort of car magazine channels back in at that time were lucky. I don't think we're especially talented or anything. We were just lucky that we would go down to test tracks like Long Cross down at Chobham or Millbrook or Myra, and there was much less regulation about what you could and couldn't do. So you could just go out and play, and you would be said, right, go off onto the Chobham slip pad and just see what cars do. If you go flat on the throttle, if you lift off, what happens to the car balance, what happens? And so we were very, very fortunate to have that exposure to things, because you were just dicking around, just went out there to mess around. And it was just, oh, this is amazing. Someone, this is a day at work. And I used to go home and tell my flatmate, you'll never guess what I've done today. I've been doing this and this. And it's, so even though, it was very, that sort of ability to have that time and exposure to it has changed. And I think it's gone for good. I can't see that time coming back, because, you know, back then we only had to write for a magazine that's 400 words for a week. And now when I send guys off on launches and things, I'm expecting them to come back with a web story, a gallery, a first drive for the magazine, social content, all sorts of things, plus news stories and everything else. So yeah, the good old days, I suppose we'd refer to them as, showing our age, showing my age at least, are probably not coming back in that regard.
It is quite insane, the difference in sort of the level of output required. Like, I've been on a few sort of press things recently, and I've been shooting like everything. Like, I've been making some sort of video, shooting photos. This time I recorded a podcast, like doing all the stuff. And then a couple of people there were writing articles. and like they're just wandering around just in like whatever t-shirt and shorts with like a phone, and they're like, oh, I'll take a couple of pictures for Instagram or whatever, and I'm there like with all my gear wandering around. I think that it's a slight insight into the sort of probably what it was more like back then.
It is. And also the thing I always think is quite interesting is if you look at the difference between, so we all deal in words and pictures on some, whether the words are moving or they're still, whatever. The difference is that it used to be that the journalist's job didn't even start until you'd finished that day's work. So the photographer would have to go home from that shoot with all the assets he needed. But the journalist, as long as he'd driven the car, didn't have to do much work on the shoot.
Yeah.
Their job started when they sat down at a word processor the next day and wrote about it. So as long as they had good, clear ideas of what they'd been up to and what they thought of the car or whatever it was, that schedule has changed now. So if for anyone doing presenting or for anything else, you basically need a script in advance. You need to know exactly what you're going to do. And then you have to sort of compartmentalize the day for what you're going to do when. So that's been a massive transformation, I think, for everyone.
Yeah. And have you found that tricky? I find it quite tricky. If I have if it gets to a certain load of different things, eventually my mind just explodes and I can't, like, trying to do a different social media platform in a different, and then record it all like in with it one another. Do you find it difficult?
I think it's borderline impossible. because there's so much you're trying to think about, and you get so many people coming to you for different things saying, right, we'll need this for that and we'll need that for this. And it's a real struggle to keep up.
Yeah.
So you do your best at any time, don't you? And then you ask for more time, because that's the one thing, that's the one give that you can probably try and get from somewhere, is get more time for something.
And if you guys are doing a review and you do a mix of, you know, presenting to camera and driving and then writing and whatever, when do you sort of start planning? How does that process start? Do you start planning the video and everything before you've, you know, even got the car, or is it some stuff blends when you've got the car? Do you get the car for like 4 days, drive it, and then film, or does it change a lot?
No. So the way it tends to work for us, I mean, we're very lucky in that Top Gear's got a lot of clout, so we can usually, if we can, we'll try and do something separate to what everybody else is doing. So if the manufacturer's having a launch of a car, we will try and get different access to it. We can do it a few days later, as long as we're still within embargo, if we're being held to everyone's being held to a certain embargo. But we will try and do it differently, separately. So we come out with a different story to everybody else, hopefully a more expansive, interesting story, because I think you serve everyone better. You serve your audience better. You serve the manufacturer better, because you've got a more diversity in what you're being told. Well, they hope, it depends on what we think of the car, but no, in essence, we only get that one access point. It's very rare for someone to say, look, we want to send you this car for a day to go and drive it, and then 4 days later we want to film it. No, because no one's got that time. You've got that one time, one piece of exposure has got to do you for everything. So you spend, you're spending a lot of time going through the data of it to try and work out what it's going to be like, where it fits into the market, what its rivals are. And you're doing as much preparation as you can in advance, which most of it is going into the script for the film you're going to make while you're there. Because I've learnt to my cost, if you turn up on a video shoot without a script, the day's going to go badly from the word go.
Yeah.
So you need to have that, at least a rough idea, and to have spoken to both the photographer and the videographer in advance, so that you all know when you get there the next morning, you're going to hit the ground running.
Yeah.
And you can, it'll wander on, it'll go hopefully smoothly from there. But the bigger the shoot and the more cars are involved, the more complex it gets. until it gets, until, yes, heads start exploding. So, but yes, you do. And then, yeah, it's that breakdown of the day and how, what you want to do. And the unfortunate thing is the often the last thing that you actually gets put on the list is drive the car and think about it.
Yes.
Because you're right, into pieces to camera. I haven't driven the car yet. How can I be talking about it?
You're driving it now.
I don't know what I'm going to say. Yeah. So it often does. And but interestingly, I often think a lot of the best opinion on the car comes when you are completely fresh to it, when you haven't driven it, when you're just getting into it, and your expectations are telling you how you thought it was going to be, and then you get into it and the reality is slightly different and you go, that's what makes this interesting. As long as you can clearly communicate that, I think you're heading in the right direction.
Yeah, and it must be really difficult because when you say you're sort of very scripting what you're going to do, say, etc., do you sort of kind of try and like bullet point and go, I'm going to talk about vaguely this and then we'll see how it actually is? Or do you literally write it and then almost learn it?
We try and build up a framework for what the, I think it probably comes from a magazine feature background, but you try and build up a general idea of what the film is going to be and what the high points are going to be, and then what you think you'll need to be talking about, and then put that into some sort of structure, which might involve, you know, a walk around of the car first, then a drive of it, and then you'll work out where some voiceover might fit in here or there, and so you're building a framework for it. Which is pretty much how we, you know, it's words and pictures again. It's the same for a magazine story. It's all words and pictures, and you're working out what's important, what's not important, what can you put in, leave out, shift around. It's an organic process, and I just still don't think for scripting that I don't feel remotely as comfortable doing that as I do writing features and drives and everything, which I can do with my hands tied behind my back.
Yeah, it's interesting that there's something, I mean, sort of brutal and has to be done about someone pressing record. And if you're speaking, you've got to say something that ticks all the boxes of all the stuff you want to deliver, but be interesting and, you know, do all those sorts of things. I think your point about when you first get in a car and you've got some sort of preconceptions of what it's going to be like, and then reporting on that, I think that particularly, that translates so well to the audience, because most people probably have a similar thought about what a car is going to be like.
Yeah.
So actually, if you address that, what people are going in their heads, they're like, oh, okay, it's not like this, or it is like this, or I think that definitely sort of relates quite well.
Yeah, I think it does. And also, I think on the whole, the audience nowadays, although they've got, they can be, there's so much information out there for them, I think on the whole, they're much better informed than they were 20 years ago. I think 20 years ago, the magazines and the early websites were the complete arbiters of information provision. Whereas now, I think there's so much comes out in drips and drabs that people pick that up. And if they're interested in something, they've already got really good, they tend to have good knowledge about it already. I think we're kept on our toes more now than we were 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah. If you say, you know, the camber's been changed on the new RS by half a degree to whatever, someone will be like, no, it's not. It's -0.25.
The problem is with a lot of this is that if you speak to two different engineers on a project, you will often get called two very slightly different things, or no, it was done that for this reason, or it was done for that reason. Now, you basically have to go back to the data sheet that is provided to you, and that is your final say. I mean, you get massive confusion over things like the weights of the cars and the power of the cars, because all European, in fact, pretty much all global manufacturers now quote PS rather than BHP, which there's a conversion factor of 0.98632 that converts one to the other. And a lot of car manufacturers quote the EU weight for a car rather than the DIN weight. The DIN weight is the weight with fluids. The EU weight adds 75 kilos for a bloke and some luggage. So passenger and luggage. So you're trying to how you sort of have to steer around these little facets and details is it's just a bit of a pain.
But, yeah, it is. Came across a sort of interesting one. I don't want to necessarily slate a certain manufacturer, but it wasn't the manufacturer's fault. It was when the new RS3 came out, and there was a lot of chat about how much power it could send to the rear. And if you read the this is when I think I have a slight engineering background and studied it, and I can read through what someone's saying. And if you have a bit more of knowledge about cars, when they say, okay, it's this type of four-wheel drive system and it can send up to 100% of the available power
to either
rear wheel, but actually the max it can send is 50% of the total.
50%, yeah.
But that confused a lot of people driving the car. And then when they asked, who was it? It was Matt Farah, I think. He asked one of the people on the launch what it could do, and they told him it could put all the power to the rear. And then you're like, how are you meant to unpick that? If you don't understand exactly how the car works, that's really difficult to unpick.
It is, yeah. And yeah, as you say, you can sometimes get conflicting advice, and then someone in the comments somewhere will shout at you.
Yeah. And you just got to go, well, this is, you know, this is what I got told. And this is to the best of my knowledge. So, right. You did work experience at what car, and then you moved, was it into what car?
So no, I was never on staff at What Car, but What Car and Autocar were in the same office. Okay, they were just they were a set of desks apart from each other. And then, so I worked for, then moved into What Car, doing a bit of editorial assistance, so a bit of everything, bit of subbing, and then moved into the road test department, which was just like every Christmas had come at once. A guy called Steve Sutcliffe was my boss, who's still around. And we had a really, really strong team. It was a good place to work. It was just, you know, I was in my early 20s and just thought this was about the best thing ever. But no, you're not, even back then, you weren't straight into Ferraris and Porsches. There was still an insurance age of, I think it was 25 that really mattered. So you had to get to age 25 before you could drive the quick stuff. I think now it's 27, 30, 35 for some stuff, I think. It was a bit more free and easy. But even back then, you know, you were off to Millbrook to do all the numbers on the cars, the acceleration tests and all the rest of it, which was just super, super exciting.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, that was just like absolute dream stuff at that point in time.
It was completely and utterly.
Writing things and whatever, was there a real atmosphere in the office of people sort of helping and critiquing and going,
was. And I think that's the most valuable thing, is that you only learn. So I used to be, I mean, showing your work to someone, it's like being back at school and having a teacher, showing your work to someone when you're actually really care about your subject, because you never did about the S3 levels of the English essay you had to do from D.H. Lawrence or something. But when you actually had to, you know, you really care about this first drive review and you put it down in front of the chief sub editor or your head of department, and it comes back covered in red ink, is right. Okay. So, and it's, you're torn between the, oh my God, I'm terrible, I should be quitting this and going and getting, doing something else. And the, well, I want to learn. And where could I be doing this a lot better than I have already? So it was a very open atmosphere, and it has been everywhere I've worked. It's had this. There is always this encouragement of the younger people coming through to try and help them find their feet and improve, because that's what you want to do, really.
Yeah, I think one thing I sort of picked up from people that write about it is a lot of people might look at the, like, what you do now and go, I want to do that because I want to drive the cars. And it's been sort of highlighted to me a few times, like, yes, you get to drive cars, But you've got to love writing. And yeah. Now you've got to sort of enjoy at least being on camera a little bit to some extent, or at least be able to sort of get away with it. Mm.
So, no, completely and utterly, you absolutely have to enjoy the writing, because that, or the writing, or the thinking, or the presenting, or whatever aspect, because it has diversified so much. And we're all, I mean, I'm there just trying to paddle frantically to try and keep up. And you have to diversify. But you have to enjoy the side of it that isn't just the driving the car, because the driving the car is, it's the means to an end. What you are trying to do is then communicate that to your audience, whether that audience is reading it, viewing it, listening to it, whatever it is. So that process you have to go through of sitting down and doing the harder graft of writing about it or structuring it, whatever, is absolutely vital to the process.
Yeah, and you've got to enjoy that part, because that is the main part.
Yeah.
With I sort of noticed looking at different magazines, and so you've worked in a few different ones. Is there like a different sort of style that each magazine sort of embodies a bit? And presumably you have some latitude in the middle. How have you found that at different places?
I think the only mainstream car magazine I haven't worked for is Car, which is ironically the magazine I grew up reading more than any other. you've got to look at the magazine in question. So each magazine will take each car they're doing and look at it from their standpoint, which means that how auto car will approach a car is very different to how what car will approach it is very different to how Top Gear would approach it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they each have different priorities about what they consider important. So whereas Top Gear considers the sort of overall excitement of the car paramount, what car is going to be the value and the practicality that counts. And that means that therefore, I'm always surprised when people say, oh, how come that car got a 9 from Top Gear, but only 7 or something from what car? Well, look at the audience, look at what they're trying to communicate and who the end user of it is. Of course, you're going to have different opinions and put different balances on things. So you've just got to decide what title or what outlet reflects you best, and then go
with
that.
I've never thought about that, but that absolutely rings true. Your auto car, Top Car, Evo, whatever. They all have a different sort of agenda spin on it, and they're going to rate it according to how they rank it.
Exactly. And then you break it down further. You know, I think for Top Gear, it's the more visceral excitement of a car that is paramount. But for Evo, I think it's the sort of the chassis dynamics and the real detail of it that is paramount. So you've got everyone will get different things from different places.
Yeah, when I was looking at, I read Top Gear magazine occasionally, and I hadn't really read it until maybe a year ago or something. And the style of article is much more jovial, fun, like not so serious. It's does that then translate into what you get to do and as a magazine? Because it sort of looks like, and it might not be the case, Top Gear is having a lot of fun making Top Gear.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the most important thing. And it's because I've been at Top Gear now for 11 years. And for me, it is the most important thing, because I think you will deliver better content. You'll have a better time if it looks to the audience like you're having fun doing it. And I think some people can get a bit chin scratchy and they'll sort of stand around and going, we're making very important decisions here. But basically behind you is parked a Ferrari, a Porsche and a Lamborghini or something. And you're just going, I'm having a brilliant time. And then you're telling people about the brilliant time you're having, which I think it swings and roundabouts, because you also want, I mean, within the BBC's remit, draw it back to that of inform, educate and entertain.
Yeah.
We need to inform and educate as well as entertain. And that has to, yeah, you have to pay homage to that at every step of the way.
What does it require to get a sort of, does Top Gear have a bigger budget than other magazines?
That's a good question. Yes, I suspect we do. But it's not night and day. So we're trying to money you've got in the best way you can. And, you know, motoring media does not have particularly big budgets now. It just doesn't. And I think since with magazine sales declining and magazine adverts having declined and a lot of money's gone out of the businesses that way, it hasn't fully been recouped through online advertising. And we all know that social media and YouTube is basically just a promotional tool.
Yeah.
You're not earning. I mean,
not making
YouTube does pay, but you've got to have a good level of content and a good level of returns in order to get any money out of it. And the investment you have to put in to make a YouTube film, I think this is probably what a lot of people don't realise. It's fine if it's just you holding a handy cam pointing at your face.
Yeah.
But if you want, if you're paying for a crew of two or something to come along for the day, plus the editing time, plus the location fees and everything else, you've got a lot of investment in that straight away. And, you know, you're not going to get that back until you hit like 5 million views on YouTube. And there's very, very little that does. So most places are, it's a bit of a loss leader, social media and YouTube.
Yeah. And you see the people that, and this is where it makes perfect sense for someone like Tim Schmee. Like, he keeps it simple, and I'm always telling him, I'm like, yeah, but come on, like, just up the production a little bit. He's like, no, it makes no sense. The audience, from what I do, does not care. In fact, they do appreciate the slightly rough and ready side of it. But then a huge part of it, views do bring in some money, but a huge part of it is working with brands and whatnot. Mm. But I presume for someone like BBC, that's actually really difficult. You can't just be having a promoted video all the time. It's got to work in the grand picture. And
it has. And you need it to, it's got to, if you think about, you know, the TV show production style, which is, you know, the quality is so high. We want the content that we're producing on the BBC studio side for Top Gear to approach that if we can. And it's important then that you invest in it to get it to that, because they, you know, but I think if equally the models that you want to be known for a style and a familiarity, because that's what will bring people back. If people like what you're doing, you don't feel the need to change it just because, oh, I've got a bit more money now. Yeah. I should get someone to point the camera at me rather than holding it myself. They like what you're doing for a reason. So yeah, I think each brand needs to have a presentation style and that works for them, really.
But it seems to be at the moment, like you're saying, it's all of the, I would say, all of the major magazines, and now we've got various networks that have started to cast up brands for YouTube and whatnot. They last about a year, maybe two, and then they're gone, because their return on investment, which was a considerable investment, I imagine, just doesn't work, which... Yeah. I love watching those style of videos because I love that level of production and whatnot. And I enjoy other content as well, but it seems like, you know, all of them burn brightly for a short period of time and then, they're gone.
I think a lot of what it is they all come into the industry with a similar mindset, which is like, car companies are huge and have money.
Yeah.
Therefore we can piggyback that, and they're happy to fly us to a racetrack in southern Europe somewhere to go and film this. So, and we do exactly the same. You know, the if someone's paying for your flights, for you and a videographer and a photographer to fly somewhere to do it, you're thinking, right, well, that is the location fees done, that is the travel cost done. Yeah. We can now get on top of this. So it's a tempting look in, because it looks quite glamorous from the outside looking in. And you've got, you know, exciting cars, and you're being given access to them. But actually still converting that into a profit out the backside, so to speak, is quite difficult. It's not you know, you there is so much exciting car content so easily delivered, whether it's from influencers, whether it's from brands themselves, whether it's from supercar owners clubs or whatever it is. There's a lot of content out there of, you know, people filming cars and coffee meets and things like that. So you're always trying to sort of deliver. I mean, it always, for me, for us at Top Gear, it always comes back to the story. You need to tell a story with that. Yeah. It's no good just going along and going, oh, look, here I am watching this drive past or that drive past. We need to be bigger than that. We have to look at it and go, right, no, we want to use that car to tell a story.
Yeah, it's that nugget there. It's got to be a story. That is the only thing that keeps people coming back and engaged. Because, like you said, there's like a bazillion videos of nowadays someone going to, especially on a launch, there's like 50 people have gone to the same event. They've all got very similar footage. Like, they're all in the same cars, the same weather. So, like, you've got to provide something that is interesting. And that is not...
interesting and different. No. And that's why we do... And we do ask to do things differently. We do ask to do it separately because it works for us, and it tends to work from all aspects. Actually, if you either have full exclusivity of something, or you've got a different idea and it's been supported and backed. So I spend an awful lot of my time trying to get access to cars to do things with. And I know we'll all be held to the same embargo, because that's how nearly all car launches and events work these days, is you are held to an embargo of between 2 or 3 days and, you know, sometimes months.
Yeah.
But you want to get access to that car and persuade the manufacturer that you should do something different with it. And to give you an example of that, back in May this year, Lamborghini were allowed a few media to drive the Countach, the recreated Countach. And they brought it to the UK, and a few people drove it in the UK and did some stories here. But I'd pitched to them from a while back that I wanted to take it to the Stelvio Pass while the pass was closed, and to drive it up and down the Stelvio Pass and so I had the Stelvio Pass to myself for 2 days. And the reason that came about goes back a decade to when in 2011, just after I joined Top Gear, we shot our car of the year, performance car of the year, on the Stelvio Pass. And one of the guys who really helped make that happen was a guy called Stefan Gander, who was the marketing director for the Südtirol Tourist Board in Austria. But we got on really well together, and over the years he's helped me do a couple of other stories in the Alps or given me the right contacts and things. And I'd said to him, look, what I really want to do, because I know when you open a mountain pass, it doesn't just open overnight, ta-da, with all the snow's gone and we're ready. It takes months. You know, they start the snow clearing process on the Stelvio in March, and it takes them until June to get the pass open, because they have to clear all the snow off, then they have to do the road repairs, the barrier checks, all this stuff, clear all the snow, clear off the rocks and stuff off the hillsides. So it takes months. So he'd very kindly on my behalf spoken to the roads department in that area and got them excited. And this is where the Top Gear name is brilliantly useful, because it opens doors. And so they'd said, right, okay, we've got some road repairs on these days that we're going to be doing lower down. But above that, the road is clear and empty and you can have it. So we had the entire Stelvio Pass to ourselves for 2 days. With the Lamborghini Countach to do that. And it was the cover story for the magazine, and we did a big YouTube film with it and lots of social content all up and around. And it was brilliant. So getting the opportunity to do things like that and to sort of you tie everything together. We've got the brand and can give you the exposure. You've got the car we want to do something with, and this location.
Yeah.
Is where we want to do it and how we want to make it all happen. And you sort of, if you've got that sort of trinity, if you like, that little triangle of power, then you can
it helps to
glue everything together.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When you're like a story like that, and you've got all these factors come in and you've got this vision and it's coming together and you're in this place on this cool road and you're the only person there with this cool car. Do you then, from a just a purely reviewing the car, let's just say the review, that's not necessarily the story, but your review of the car, does that get warped because you're like, well, this is mega?
No. To be fair, I stood at the top of the Stelvio Pass with that car next to me, and I said, and did the pinch myself I do whenever I have events like this, is imagine you were 12 and yeah. You realised that this was going to be your job. How cool would that be? Because I think it's so exciting to do it. But no, I can completely separate the time I'm having with the car and doing that story from the car itself, because actually I've said some pretty unkind things about the Countach because I don't think it's a particularly great piece of design. I think it's just Lamborghini working out how they can make an awful lot of money, 200 million quid out of selling 100 of them to people, and it's a little bit cynical. I have no problem in separating what I'm doing from the car I'm driving. But I often think that it doesn't really matter, because I think for the manufacturer, they're excited to have that car doing that story. And even if the story comes out of it maybe slightly negatively, or your opinion on the car comes out of it slightly negatively, you've still got a really powerful piece of communication there.
Yeah, and people are reading it, watching it, doing it. And I imagine when you start getting to the switchbacks, the Stelvio Pass, you're like, the turning radius of this car is not particularly great. And,
it definitely, I was very glad it had the nose lift. So you come charging up to the hairpins and you have to go through a full sequence of making sure, because the nose lift took ages. So you need to sort of do the countdown right so the nose would come up and then you could turn around the corner. So it was, and then, you accelerate out first gear, and I think it was 25 miles an hour, the nose lift goes back down, so then you've got to get back on it. So the whole theme of that story was that this is possibly the least suited car to the Stelvio Pass. You imagine they're going to be this great partnership, but actually they both have constraints on each other. So it's probably the worst place to test it, but it didn't matter, because as a partnership of that, it allowed us to say some quite interesting things about the car and about the place and all that sort of thing. Into it in a bit more detail, which is great. But for me, it's always it's rarely the car I get excited about, and I don't think that's just because of being a cynical hack who's been doing this for a very long time. I think it's that places and cultures and things are inherently more interesting than the car.
Yes.
And putting a car into that situation is what makes it relevant to us and gives us the fantastic stories we can do.
Yeah. One of my favorite sort of types of photograph at the moment, if I'm going to go shoot something, is epic place, epic time of day, epic landscape shot with a tiny car in it that's like the right car for that location, place and time. That's my favorite now, because it just for me sums up all of the stuff around a nice tightly cropped car in a frame. Does pretty much nothing for me, because I can read the spec sheet and see some photos.
Yeah, exactly. So no, I completely agree. So people say to me, oh, what's the best thing you've ever done, or what greatest things that you do? And they expect me to say it was driving some of the really amazing stuff I've got to drive, but it rarely is, because you're usually, when you do that, very constrained on things. You've got five laps in whatever it is, or you've got an hour with this or whatever. And actually, some of my favourite things have been the much more expansive stuff. Like about 6 years ago, Toyota launched the Hilux in Namibia, which they had this very organised plan of how they were going to do it, where they were going to drive. And I looked at it and went, that's not what I want to do if I'm going to Namibia. So I managed to persuade Toyota to give us a Hilux separately to everybody else. And we did this thing of looking, because the Hilux is, the reputation it has is for bulletproof reliability. Yeah. So we said, well, how about, so it is the ship of the desert. It's like the equivalent of, it's the automotive equivalent of a camel. It's the ship of the desert. Yeah. And if you look within Namibia, there are ships in the desert. So we did this story of driving the ship of the desert to meet the ship in the desert, because there's this ship called the Edward Bolan, which shipwrecked on the Skeleton Coast over 100 years ago. But as all the sands and things have moved, it is now half a mile inland. So, and it's a whacking great 400-foot freighter in the middle of a desert. So we did this story driving down to that and spent two nights in the desert. And it was just absolutely epic. And in terms of having the right car in the right place, doing the right thing, it was amazing. And I still cite that as a, because you're always looking for an idea to be clean, easily communicable, so people can open up the magazine or
yeah.
click on a link in a bio or look at a YouTube thumbnail and go, yes, that's what I want to get out of this.
Yeah, totally.
So, yeah.
With all of these pulling the right car to the right place at the right time, are you sort of responsible for the car of the year or involved in yes. the putting the stuff together?
So for Speed Week, Performance Car of the Year, that's my baby. Yeah, yeah.
Is that as much of a headache as I feel like it probably is?
Yes. No, more. So every single year, I say to everyone the same things, which is that we will start early, which we always do. We start trying to gather the cars in February or March to shoot it in September, and everything will look rosy as you like right up until about August. And then in August, you'll start to get cars dropping out. You'll start to get things will start to slip, because they always, always do. And it was true. We've just, this month's magazine's just been, is out right now in the shops, or depending on where this is going out.
Yeah.
But it's the issue that's on sale now. It's where there's all sorts of stuff going on to YouTube and on the topgear.com website at the moment. It's a really strong issue because we went somewhere we hadn't been before, went to the Czech Republic to do it. We took fewer cars because of the complexities, but also because we had so many drop out.
Right.
Because the absolute rule of number one rule is you need good cars. So the idea is the best cars of that year, the best sports and performance cars of that year, all gathered together. And every year there are one or two key ones that you can't get the dates to line up, or there's only one in Europe, or it's been crashed last week, or whatever happens. It all goes on. But this year we were in the unusual situation where we had, at least five that didn't make it. And it, for me, that was a bit of heart-rending, really, in that we had the McLaren Artura, which we'd already driven back in June.
Yeah.
We were told we couldn't have one of those. Same with the Lotus Emira, which we'd driven back in May or June. We'd told that was a production car, and it clearly hadn't been a production car when we'd driven it. And so those are companies that have had big issues and sort of fairly well-documented issues of trying to get those cars into production. Then cars from giant companies that you'd assume would have no issues with developmental problems. So we missed out on a Merck SL63.
Right,
which means it wasn't a key car, but that's Mercedes, having launched that car 9 or 10 months earlier, still being unable to get one for Top Gear Speed Week. And same with the Toyota GR86. Again, that is an absolute heartland car for us. And they were unable to get it because of Toyota Gazoo Racing wanting to make some final adjustment before anyone drove, which sounded like a little bit of a obfuscation cheat round the side. Who knows what's going on there? And then the last one, which was a shame because the North, well, it's going to be on the next series of the TV show. And it, because it makes the most insane noise ever, is the Pagani Huayra R.
Yes.
Which I drove back in June, July. And I just thought, no, for the noise alone, we need to have that at Speed Week because it'll just be incredible.
What's that like to drive? Because it sounds insane.
It's bananas. It's bananas. But to drive, it's actually really friendly. I mean, the thing to remember with any racing car, any of these sort of what you might call a gentleman's racer, these 2 million quid hypercars that are racing cars basically, but they're refettled to be friendly to drive. There's so many adjustment parameters you can put into them to make them better or work, you know, better or more friendly and approachable to drive than a full house racing car, which is, you know, a much more aggressive, fidgety thing, and it's all done with the setup. So no, in terms of to drive, that thing was just wild because it was so sharp and lovely and actually sharp and yet smooth to drive. But every time you're on the gas, just this 140 decibels of screaming 9,000 RPM V12 accompanied you down every straight, and it's just so exciting to do stuff like
that. Yeah, I can imagine. Do different manufacturers of, let's say, that style of car set them up when you drive them, because I guess that's all you have as a reference point, in a similar sort of way, like whether it's like a tiny bit of high speed understeer or do they differ a bit?
No, I think on the whole they do it so they are what they would call they want to make sure they get to the end of that event with the car still intact.
Yeah.
So they don't want them all being hurled into barriers on the first corner. So I suspect they do. Yeah. I suspect there's a nice sort of relatively friendly setting that they work with. But yes, we often get asked you've got to show, you know, what you've driven before that makes you able to come and drive this, and just to make sure that they're trying to mitigate against disaster. I think
that's always quite a funny. Do you just sort of point them and go, look, YouTube, just do a Google? Or by now, well, they know enough, who you are.
I mean, but people now ask less because your driving back catalogue is more obvious because it is viewable on YouTube or on the website or whatever. But yes, no, in the past it's been quite tight and tough at times. They've said, we need you to have had single seater experience or this sort of thing. It swings and roundabouts, but yeah, by and large, people do want to make sure that you're not going to stuff it as soon as you get there. The one I remember best of all was, which amazed me, that we got to do it in the first place, because I'd done some stuff with Mark Webber when he was driving for the Porsche Le Mans prototype LMP1 car, and I'd said to him just in passing, you know, do you think they will ever let anyone outside the race team drive one of these cars? And he went, mate, it's never going to happen, they're so specialist, they need such a, no one will ever drive one. And then about 6 months later I got a phone call from Audi asking if I wanted to drive the R18 TDI
nice
car, because it was when they pulled out, and basically the team had been given such little notice that this was going to happen and were so pissed off, they went, right, okay, if they're pulling the plug on us, we're going to let the media drive it. So we all went down. They did it in December at Neuburg, is Audi's test track, which is a tiny little Mickey Mouse track, so you're never going to get a proper feel for the car. And you were driving it in December, so they sent you out on hot, warm tyres and said, there's no chance you can keep any heat in them. Just have a good go for a couple of laps and then just trundle about, because you'll fall off if you don't. But they before that, they asked a lot of questions, and I think they only let 7 global media drive it, or maybe even less. But they said to us, we need to make sure that A, you're under 5'10",
right,
B, you weigh no more than this, C, we need to know all this. And it's because you were sitting in, I think it was Loic Duval or so, I can't remember who the driver was, but you were sitting in his seat.
Yeah.
And he was a pipsqueak, whatever it was. But the Germans sent a guy down, having been told all this, who was 6'2".
Oh.
and he physically couldn't operate the car. So one of those slots went, and I think they put me in the car for a second bite so we could get some photography and stuff done. But those sorts of experiences don't come along very often. But that was an amazing one because the team was so emotional. And when we got there, the team boss said to us, please spend some time talking to the guys today because this is the last time the car will ever run. They were doing something the following day for friends and family and VI and people who had supported the project and internal people. But this was the day before in December. Please spend some time with the guys because they're all on their way out and they'd all basically been told their next project was probably going to be a Formula E car. And I think they were just sort of thinking, oh, Christ, what did it come to? So you get, those sorts of events are just amazing.
What was it like driving a Audi LMP1 car?
It's amazingly small inside, which I know sounds natural, but you sit like you're in a bathtub. So you're sort of like this with your knees right up round here and the steering wheel sits between your chest and your knees. Mm. It's like there. It's just so close and your feet are up and then you're just, you're basically just pointing ahead in this tiny little pod and there's been lots of instructions. So normally when you do this sort of stuff, they give you the day before you get there or something, or they have a briefing the day before where they give you a picture of the steering wheel and say, learn this. You need to know this,
yeah,
this.
Yeah, yeah.
And you need to know not to press that and that or twist that. And you go, oh, right, okay. It's like playing Boggle or something. You've just got just a jumble in your head of stuff. The thing that you're always looking for defining characteristics that would distinguish that from anything else. And with that car, it was because of how they organized the electric power and the internal combustion power, you came out of a corner and it was like you hit warp speed and you jumped the first 200 meters down every straight.
Yeah.
So as you'd come out of a corner in second gear, and that's what Neuburg has. It has second gear corner. So you trundle around the corner and then you'd gone, right, I can bury it now. And you buried it and the thing had just gone, whoof, and you'd accelerated so fast, it just felt like you'd leapfrogged the first 200 meters because all the torque from the engine and all the big hit of electric is they've worked out the most efficient way is to get you to do the first bit of the acceleration curve. And after that, the acceleration could back off. And so for Le Mans and stuff, your acceleration curve went like that and then like that.
Yeah.
So that was the defining thing about that car.
Did those hybrids, they had a... There was a speed that the hybrid system had to disengage. They do now. In LMP1, did they have that?
Yeah.
It was like,
I can't remember.
120 or something.
To be fair, we were never going to be up above. I don't think we ever got. I got beyond 200 kilometers an hour. I'd have been surprised if we did any point on Neuburg because it's not a big circuit. But yeah, you're just there thinking, don't be the one who puts this one in the barriers.
Had you driven anything sort of similar, like LMP2 or anything like that before then?
Yes, I'd driven a couple of other bits and pieces. I can't remember. I'd spent a lot of time not a lot of time, but I'd driven Nissan's Zeod and the Delta Wing before that, when it was called Wing Project. We'd done some stuff with that, and I'd done quite a lot of GT3s and single seaters. I'd driven on a red letter day that I still talk about endlessly to anyone who will listen. I drove Alain Prost's Formula One car back in 2014, 1986. I think it was 86, Renault RE40 twin turbo F1 car at the Dijon-Prenois circuit, which was just,
I bet that was quite
something. Astonishingly astonishing. And it still goes down as pick. That's never going to happen again. And thank you very much indeed.
Yeah.
I have a marvelously diverse portfolio of what I've been lucky enough to drive over the years. And it's that's what it's all about to me. I wouldn't, I'm not so weirdly, I'd like to sort of have the lots of different diverse experiences rather than just sort of pursuing one thing, if you like.
Yeah, totally.
Although rallying is probably a bit my heartland and I do get a bit excited about that.
I went to my first WRC event last weekend. Went to Rally
Spain. Did you?
Which it was a sort of baptism of fire and I did it with Toyota, which was great. Like you just pop in on a helicopter and watch some rallying, pop out and do something else, have some lunch and whatnot. I felt a little bit bad that I didn't get to sort of get out in the early morning in the dark with the fog and the lights sort of flopping around and whatnot. But it's I'm now interested 100%. So cool.
I think because I've been taking my son to watch rallying since he was 4 or 5 years old. Mm. We used to go and walk just to go and watch Rally GB.
Yeah.
Because I remember the first time I saw a rally car, when I was early 20s and stuff, and went off with some mates to watch it in Wales, and just being absolutely mind blown. And that was full Colin McRae era of stuff, and just being. Well, I think we'd watched, that's right, we'd watched, what really set it for me is we'd watched the national cars come through, and the national guys are quick, but then they'd blown the whistles and they'd said, right, we knew the international cars were coming, the full house cars coming. And the first one, the line he took was entirely different. I can't remember who it was. It might have been like Armin Schwarz or something in a Hyundai accent or something. But the line he took, the approach he was on, the speed he was carrying was just, it was just staggering, absolutely staggering. And I've never lost that. Whenever you watch WRC these days, the speeds they are doing is just bananas, absolutely bananas. And I've been lucky enough to drive a couple of the cars, and they just blow your mind because, basically they blow your mind when you're sat next to someone who really knows what they're doing. Because that is, it's just like, oh my God, this is not going to work. Everything's clenched.
I've had that with, driving on track, and then you get a pro to drive the car and you're driving something, and that's always like, oh, okay. But I imagine being in a rally car is another level above, because there's a whole level of commitment that you just doesn't exist on track that does on a stage with trees.
Yeah, I think it's because the terrains are so varied. So on a track lap, every 3 miles you'll be going back past the same bit of scenery, and you can work out exactly where the margins are. You know where this bit, where the outer limits of the apex and the corner and stuff is. But with rallying, you're not going past the same bit of scenery each time, and in fact, you don't know what bit of the surface, what the surface is doing beneath you. And it's so you're putting your trust in them much more. And then when you throw in trees and rocks and log piles and all the rest of it, you just go, oh, it can all go so badly wrong. So, yeah.
It's pretty cool. So with all these, looking at different experiences and whatnot, I've always looked at, say, and most of the magazines do some sort of performance car of the year type thing. And I look at it and go, well, okay, but this is, and I know it's what you've got to do, but this is cars that have come out this year. And if I was asking the people that are doing it, if you could pick any car to drive maybe in a 5-year period, it would look completely different as a lineup.
Yeah.
Now, to sort of take that a bit further, if you were doing a sort of cars of your life, in terms of you've driven, but you've got to put a top 5 or a top 10, let's just say 5, but ideally with slightly different experiences, what would you throw in there for to just the all-time greats on a sort of car of your life event?
Yeah. It's difficult because you're exactly right. And I'll make this point now, is that the supercars have got so fast now that you fundamentally can't use them. I've just got back from doing the cover story for the next issue of the magazine, which involves cars costing less than 30,000 quid, trying to have fun in cars costing less than 30,000 quid, and had a better time on roads in any of those than I've had driving various Ferraris and Lamborghinis, where you just physically cannot use the performance they're capable of. And because you're not using their performance, you're basically just dawdling around. And yes, there's something exciting about being able to use some of the revs, some of the time, and enjoying the steering feel or whatever else it is. But you don't feel like you're properly partnering those cars. So with that said, what would I put into a top 5 all-time stuff? Can I have racing cars?
Yeah, you can chuck racing cars in there. I feel like we might end up with 5 racing cars, though.
No, I wouldn't, actually.
Put a couple in.
I, Do you know, I'd only put a WRC car in. Ooh. I'd put a Full House WRC car in because those have been the cars that have most scrambled my brain, I think. Then, this is putting me on the spot. I'd have a Ferrari F40 in there.
Yeah.
Whenever anyone else says to you, what's the best road car you've ever driven? I still think a Porsche 997 GT2, GT3 RS I'd put in there because that would be my banker. I know I'd have a brilliant, brilliant time driving it. I'd probably put a Lotus Elise in there because I think they're fabulous.
Yeah.
And I love lightweight stuff. I don't know. That's a bit of a starter anyway. What would you put in?
Well, I smiled because I've owned and own one of those cars. So I had an F40 until a year ago.
Did you? Oh, wow.
Which was mega. But I just sort of got to the end of my time with it in terms of value and whatever. Didn't use it. But as an on-road experience on a B road, that was very, very high up there. Mainly, all the things, obviously. I'm sure you've driven one. Like, the sketchiness factor is a huge part of the enjoyment and the fact that the suspension is a bit rubbish by modern day standards. Yeah. So it's always moving around and whatnot. And I have a 997 Gen 2 RS that I've had for 10 years. That's pretty mega.
For me, cars are exciting when they have more power than grip.
Yes.
That's fundamentally what makes them exciting. But when they have, with modern stuff now, which does have more power than grip, but the limits are so high of the grip that you're just like, this is going to go, if anything happens, this is going to be a bit silly.
Even think now, as time goes on, like my RS, I think that's got more power, more grip than I want. And at least on cup twos, on a dry day, it's like, you're not really exploring. It'll take all the power most of the time, unless you're committed.
Yeah.
Sort of sending
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yes.
You drove.
Yeah.
A pretty cool thing recently. I saw you drove James Dean's M3.
Yes, I did. Yeah.
Drift car.
Actually, it's a 320 diesel.
Oh, okay.
It started life as a 320 diesel, and I think we did put M3 in the YouTube bit. But yes, I did, and that was amazing. Actually, that was a car that surprised me simply because I didn't expect it to be. Well, I mean, actually, having said that, I should have expected it, because if you watch him, you look at the cornering speeds they're doing in drifting, they're going very, very fast.
Yes.
So what I was doing was applying my knowledge of skidding about on tracks and sliding around to a Full House drift car where you had to be so much more committed to the corner in order for it to work properly. So, you know, my knowledge of getting stuff to slide around corners is you set it up set it up as early as you can, but then you unsettle it, boot the throttle, get it to an angle, and then you're dealing with it. And actually, once you're at that stage, that's the easy bit, and it's coming out that's the difficult bit. But with his car, it needed to be unsettled all the time. Now, it had more than enough power to do that. It was nearly 900 horsepower as we were driving it. But the speeds were so dizzying. Once the tyres got hot, and they're only running at about 8 PSI, there's barely any air in them at all. Super low pressure, masses of grip. So you had to be really physical with it. And once it was sliding, then you could be more fluent with it. But to get it to go in the first place, you really had to upset it or carry a dazzling amount of speed.
Yeah.
And that shoot actually happened twice because we were meant to, we did it at Dunsfold originally, which I was really happy about, masses of runoff.
Yeah.
But on that day, the car broke down and we actually couldn't drive the car for about another 2 or 3 months because of a lot of his commitment stuff.
Yeah.
So we then went to Mondello Park in Ireland to drive it, which doesn't have anything like as much runoff. So I was bricking it a bit, but it really is an amazing experience because actually, I found it, once I got used to the speeds you have to commit to things at, I found it quite easy because the angles I'm used to committing things to, which is basically half a turn to a full turn of lock in a road car, well, you were barely halfway through the steering lock on a drift car. You could just carry on. So if you gave it too much, you could always put more on. And that was, that was bananas, actually. So, yeah, what a thing. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I'd love to drive something like that. That sounds really intimidating to start with.
It is quite intimidating, and I think I said it in the film. I was deeply unsure about it because I thought maybe it'll be easier if it's wet, and then I realised that actually if the surface is inconsistent, as it was, because we had a little bit of rain and stuff come through that day, and that engine, I'd never driven anything with a 2JZ that I know everyone goes on about. I don't think I'd ever really driven anything, not with a 2JZ that had a turbo this big bolted onto it and everything else. And what I couldn't believe with that engine is how responsive it is. There's no anti-lag in those on that turbo, but how responsive that engine is, and then how quickly it builds up through the revs. So as soon as it loses traction, it basically it's at the red line.
Yeah.
So on a couple of places, there was an off camber bit where it was still wet and it lit up. And there's a bit on the film where you see me go, whoa, it's because it just bit instantly. And just like, my God. And I didn't think it wasn't even on the throttle that hard, but it was enough to upset it. And yeah, it gets very exciting
and does
very quickly.
The power tail off quickly once you're in it. If you lift off, does it drop slowly or is it like...
No, it does. You've got very, very good throttle control on it. Really good throttle control. So you could be really accurate with it. But it didn't like going... It didn't like going being driven straight.
Yeah.
It's got a locked rear diff. So as soon as you turn in, you're getting... Kung, 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 it just wants to go straight on. But as soon as it was flying around, then it was... Yeah, it was a lot. It was a lot of fun. I was really starting to get into it. Then I broke the gearbox, or the gearbox broke, or something let go. Anyway,
things happen. Yeah.
So it was a great shame, and I had to apologise to James.
Yeah. Did you watch the latest Jim Carna, the Ken Block's Audi one?
Watched it. Yeah.
What do you think of that?
It wasn't my favourite. I have to say, I just didn't think it, although the venues were great, I didn't think it showcased all it could have done, actually, I have to say.
I think with previous locations and cars, I think they've done, the one that stands out for me is San Francisco, as like jumping over all the roads or... Mm. I missed some noise, but I was watching it and I was trying to work out why I wasn't that bothered. There was a one reverse entry that I was like, oh my God, this is mad. Just, you can tell all the talk and it's just fully on it. Mm. But then the rest of it, like I say, it was just kind of like, well, he's just going around some corners.
I have to say, it did feel like they'd forced the other Audis in there a bit as well. Yeah. I don't mind having other product in the back of frame, but hang on, this is your Audi. This is meant to be Audi getting excited about its electric future. And here they are showing us all the cool stuff they used to do. I thought that was a little bit forced. There just wasn't quite enough variety in it. And I didn't want to see a car sliding around an underground car park in Las Vegas. Las Vegas is full of amazing locations. You use that instead. Yeah. But there was some lovely cinematography in it. And a couple of those high speed reverse entries were wicked.
Yeah.
But it wasn't my favorite. Do you know, I go back to one of the really early ones, the one that is shot at Montlhéry Circuit out on the outskirts in France, I think, which was it the first with the Fiesta?
And it was going around planes and stuff?
I can't remember if it did, but there was a load of stuff on steep banking and things.
Yeah.
And I remember at the time that being, oh my God, that's so cool. But again, the San Francisco one was wicked as well.
I think and this is a problem. It's a bit like, it's where we're at with all sort of media, is you've just seen so much stuff. Like for them, they've done so many awesome, really sick, cool things with insane cars that like, it must be a nightmare trying to come up with something new. But I think that first Jim Carna when I think it was like them drifting through a building from outside through the building to outside again. And I was like, oh my God, I've never seen that before. Like,
I mean, this is the thing. I mean, where do you, how do you draw a line? Because this, you know, and how do you progress things any further? It's got to a bit of a natural breaking point now where the, you, it's pretty far fetched what a lot of what he's doing. And I don't know how you take it any further than that. So
no, it's an interesting one. Right. Well, I normally wrap these up with five questions, and I feel like, given the times, we should start to get to that point. Do you have a most memorable driving trip or journey?
I've got a couple. That one I was talking about in Namibia earlier was brilliant. But the other one I usually cite where the car was not the star of the show, but the experience was. And this is going to be a little bit of a long answer, but the car was an Infiniti QX70.
No, I don't know.
But the story was amazing. So I, at a motor show, was talking to the CEO of Infiniti. And the CEO of Infiniti at the time, this is back in 2016, 17, I think maybe 18, was one of those sickening people who's not only the CEO of an international car company, but has also hiked solo to the South Pole and done all this amazing thing. As a result of that, he'd got, I think he was a member of the American Geographic Association or Geographic Society. And he'd been to a presentation there where they'd been talking about how Mongolian paleontologists were looking for dinosaur fossils in Mongolia.
Right.
And but needed funding in order to help it because they'd figured out that if they used drones with different cameras using different wave bands of light, they could spot likely areas to dig for fossils, but they needed investment. So Infiniti had said, well, I'd love to sponsor this, but in order to sponsor it, I need to make sure we can get something back from it. I need to make sure we can get some exposure or something. So he'd mentioned this to me at a motor show and said, do you think this is the sort of thing you might be interested in? Would you be, you know, how could you give it some coverage? I went, yeah, absolutely. If you can get us out to Mongolia, we will very happily report on this. So we did this amazing story where I spent 3 or 4 days in the Gobi Desert with paleontologists using drones and then digging for fossils. And we found, because you do in Mongolia, it's astonishing. We found baby velociraptors.
Wow.
Heads of amazing things. And it's the absolute story that I don't think that story would float in any other media title. I don't think you could use it. And it's a shame in a way. And it's much more of a travel piece than it is a car piece. But it enabled us to tell cultural stories, which I think are really interesting, and we do, and we try to do a lot of whether you know America, Japan, wherever. But we, I think those stories are really important because it's not about the car; it's about the culture that is associated. And they were reliant on these cars to get them into the parts of the desert, and then I had to drive back to Ulaanbaatar with a plaster cast containing two velociraptors. And you just think, my God, where in my life choices did this come from? But I like it.
That is...
So having the ability to do things like that, that story I think is one I'll be telling for a long time to come.
That is super cool. And that is, yeah, that's that melding of the two, like great story. There's some cars involved, but like,
yeah,
great story. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, sports car, what would it be?
Probably a Lotus Elise. I think it probably would be every time I see a, I've got one, and every time I get in that, I just think it's my reset button. It's just, it's so pure and so lovely, and it's a Series 1, and it's absolutely standard, and I never want it to be faster. I never want it to do anything else. I look at it, the beautiful little stack instruments and the tiny little steering wheel, and just think, this is perfection. So I think it would probably be that, and I'd dawdle about B roads and just have a lovely time.
Yeah. Nice. Nice. I like that. Because I think for a lot of people, they go like, what's the craziest thing I can think of? And then generally the people that
No, because I get to do all the crazy stuff through the through my job. And it, what I like is having a reset button that brings me back to what really matters. Because what really matters to me is the feel and dexterity and having actually having to concentrate on the driving and having a clutch and a gearbox and feeling some stuff back through the chassis and the steering. And I'm afraid that I think most modern supercars and hypercars now are just, they're force deliverers. They just hit hard, and but they don't integrate you into the process so much.
No, not at all. And it's funny, I look back at certain cars, like the Aventador actually, and I haven't driven one in a while, but I imagine that's better now than when it came out because it's a bit crap. Like, whereas...
Yeah.
And those, that will feel more sort of, I don't know, authentic, you know, the sort of the gear shift. I don't really want to drive around town, but on a right road, I think you're going to get more of an experience than a 8,000 horsepower, whatever, just delivered to the road.
Mm.
But yeah.
Yeah, quite. Murcielago SV, that's a car to have a good, that's a car to have a thrash in as
that,
well.
That is a car I think it's so cool. Such a cool car.
Yeah, it is.
Most undervalued car at the moment. What should be worth more?
Ooh. Most undervalued car at the moment. See, I've currently got my eye on Audi R8 V8 manual, the original 2007 car, which is still under 40K. And I keep thinking the values of those look tempting.
Yeah.
In a way that they shouldn't be, almost. And even the fact that in the last 2 years, people have really started talking about them being undervalued and everything, and I'm still looking at them and go, stop talking about
them. Yeah.
Trying to get money across the line somehow.
I saw one the other day, drove past, and I was like, that is really cool. Like, the R8 is a cool shape. Manual gearbox.
Yeah.
Cool sounding V8. Not crazy fast.
And I'm somewhere in there, there will be... There must be a brilliant story about why that was as good as it was when it first came out and what Audi was thinking internally that made them think, we want to smash the 911 and all of that stuff, because it is a really, really good car.
Yeah. Would you have a 911 or an R8?
Oh, generally speaking, a 911.
Yeah.
But back in 2007, an R8.
What is the most interesting car to you at the moment? What are you looking at, Googling?
That R8 too much. Interesting car to me at the moment. I tend to like stuff. So because I can't think of an answer off the head, I'm going to answer by talking myself probably into something.
Yep.
But I like cars that surprise and generally do things that aren't, you know, so you can't work out exactly where they've come from or what they're doing. So surprising cars is what I always look for somewhere in a template. But at the moment, I honestly can't think of anything. I tell you what, no, I can think of something. I'm intrigued by the reasoning behind the Lamborghini Huracan Sturato, which they're going to build next year as a sort of gravel off-road.
Oh, that one, right. Yeah, supercar. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I'm intrigued by that. But I know I've sort of already sort of know what it might well be like, and I like what I think it will be like.
Yeah.
And I know Porsche are going to do the same probably with a 911. I don't know if they're going to call it a Safari
Dakar,
or a cross-country or Dakar.
The name is getting thrown around.
Yeah. Yeah. And I like the idea of that a lot. But it's a bit like, I love my cycling and road bikes, and it's a bit, those cars to me are a bit like the gravel bike trend in bikes. Yeah. In that everyone goes, oh my God, that's brilliant, I want one of those. And actually you think, oh, it's just a road bike with fatter tyres.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit concerned that those are going to be how fit for purpose they're going to be.
That is, I've got that sort of thought about whether it's the 911 Dakar or whatever, because I see people sliding around sort of safaried cars and you see all the weight transfer and you go, that looks like fun. But will these deliver a different experience to... normal car, or do they just look jacked up and that's it?
No, and the other thing that just is a fundamental ongoing interest for me is anyone who does a hot hatch. It's still just do a good hot hatch. Don't worry about electric. I'm not fussed about that, because, you know, a good hot hatch is such an efficient and entertaining and well-packaged bit of kit. You know, it'll do, if it does 30 or 35 to the gallon, it doesn't really matter. But they're more visceral, engaging than most modern supercars, I think.
Yeah, and one of my favourites, the Fiesta, is gone.
It's going to die.
There's no replacement.
That's an absolute travesty. I mean, I haven't read up enough on Ford's reasoning. I can predict what it's going to be, and it sounds a bit lame to me because I still think, you look at the amount they're still selling of those,
yeah,
and how popular they are and how integrated into our car culture they are. I don't quite see how they replace it or what they replace it with that's going to be accessible to 90% of people who don't care what they drive, but they want it to be affordable and easy and everything else that the Fiesta is. Plus, it has a bit of verve to it.
Yeah, and if you're a sort of young petrolhead, generally most people at some point in time end up with a Fiesta ST. Like it is so much fun at that price point, and it's just so much fun, full stop.
Yeah.
And Puma, it's not the same.
No. No, it's not. It's not. It's a good crossover, but that's damning it with faint praise.
Yeah, different thing. Right, final question. Five-car garage, unlimited value.
Oh, that's just impossible, isn't it? What would I put in it? I'd put an F1 in it. I would put a McLaren F1 in it.
Yeah.
I would put in, because this is a story that's going in the next issue of the magazine, and this is going to sound ridiculous, but I put into it either a Mercedes G-Wagon or a Defender towing a Bruder caravan. And Bruder is an Australian caravan. You'll have to look it up. Bruder. They make these amazing expedition caravans. Oh, and right. I did a big story with one, driving it up to Scotland back in the summer. I would absolutely have one of those because we've got a camper van at home, a VW Cali, which we use all the time as our stuff.
Yeah.
Family wagon. And I love it, but I think it might have been trumped in my affections now by a Bruder caravan. So I would have that as my rig. That would be my rig. That and an F1. I'd have possibly a Jaguar XKSS. That's the thing. Yeah, the EXP6. That's the big picture there. That's what just identical to that nearly... Oh, wow,
look at
Scotland.
That.
Yeah.
It's hilarious.
So they've got up to 600 mil of ground clearance. They float, so you can take them through... take them across river crossings and stuff. It's all air suspension, so you on the move, you can twilt it and move it and change it around. Ah, just incredible things. Absolutely.
What's the damage on one of those?
About £120,000 for the caravan.
Quite a lot.
Yeah, about 115 start. I think the one I had with all the kit on it was 127.
Yeah.
But it's got like cabin pressurization systems. It's got all sorts of trick bits of kit. Wild, wild thing. I might well have an XKSS or a C-Type.
Yeah, nice.
Because I think that's my favourite classic. I'd stick a 205 GTI in there, I think.
Mm.
I've got a 306 Rally outside, but I think I'd have a 205 GTI. I need a hot hatch in there anyway, and I think it would be that.
You go older, probably lighter, less grip.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Older, lighter, and then probably put a 2-litre MI16 lump in it. I've driven the Tolman Engineering do a car that we had last year as part of our speed week, which I just loved. I thought it was so engaging, if you like. And if I could, I'd have a WRC car, and then I'd go and rent Sweet Lamb and Walter's Arena and Aberyn and whatever other stages I could in Wales and do that.
They are, and I hadn't really thought about this much, but they are the only, maybe... modern, fully up to date, fully wham bam race car that you can drive on the road.
Yeah. So we've done it actually. I've done it as part of stories before. In fact, sorry to bang on, but I'll just to give you another little story. Back in 2014, I did a story on turning a Hyundai i20 into a rally car. So I took it literally off a boat from Korea, turned it into a rally car over the course of a year, which ended up in this basic white car doing Wales Rally GB.
Nice.
And I said to the WRC team, because it was just when the WRC team was starting out, I said to them, if I win my class, can I drive the WRC car? And they went, yeah, because there's no chance of it happening. Anyway, long story short, we won our class on Wales Rally GB. And good as gold, the following year at Wales Rally GB, the car that had finished third, I think it was Danny Sordo's car, came off the podium. They said, there it is, with three mechanics and a trailer. Off you go. Do whatever you want. So I had it for 2 days. I had the WRC car, literally just finished Wales Rally GB. And so I went and drove it on my favourite roads through, like, around Bala and Festiniog in North Wales. Loaded it into the trailer. We did some stuff around Shrewsbury. We took it down to London. I drove it all the way around London, Piccadilly Circus and everything overnight. I got stopped by the police a couple of times that evening. Can you make it quieter? What are you playing at?
Yeah.
Please piss off. So drove it around there and then took it down to Lyddon Hill Rallycross Circuit on another day to go and drive it down there, following day to drive it down there. So, yeah, that was, bananas. So, yeah.
And what's it like driving on the road in something like that? Is it too much?
Rowdy?
Or?
No, it's not, because they're so compliant, especially if they're in gravel trim.
Yeah.
They're so compliant. And they drive on the road with cans on. So you and your co-driver, you just plug into the onboard Peltor and then you just, just fine. So you're just there going, and it's all very short geared. So it's noisy and stuff. I think they gave me a limit of 300 miles we could do in it in total. So we had to transport it between places and things. I think it was that. So that was just, brilliant.
In gravel spec on the road, was it quite loose?
It feels like it is. So what I always say to people when they say what's a full house rally car like to drive, it's astonishing because it's so nimble. So any input you put into the car, it responds immediately to. Mm. It feels like it just, you can change direction on top of pinhead when in them. But any input that the terrain puts back into the car is never deflected off course. It doesn't seem to have any impact. So when we had one down at Speed Week in 2019 at Portimao on the rally course at Portimao. We also drove it on the track because it was hilarious. But any input you go, so I hit big rocks and lumps and things, and the steering wheel would you'd know you'd hit it, but it would never knock the car off course. So that ability of you feeling so nimble, whatever you did to the car, and yet anything that was an external influence that hit the car, never deflected it at all, was astonishing. And that, I know they spend 20,000 quid a corner or more on dampers alone, and they have billet made engines, but in terms of the perfection of the engineering that puts something together, someone who's, none of us will ever be Formula One drivers, but you could appreciate the engineering in a rally car without having to be at a bonkers level.
Yeah. And when you see them driving, and these guys are like absolute heroes, but nowadays it's so smooth. It's like they're on a tarmac. Like, there might be a bit of correction here and there, but they are so just like, I'm going in that direction, and the car's just dealing with everything. It is incredibly impressive.
It is. It really is. So, yeah. Question for you then. How did you get into this? How do you get to where you are now?
I don't have tons of time, but I'll give you a short sort of setup. Studied engineering at university. Got distracted by skiing, went and did a lot of skiing, became a ski instructor, did a lot of skiing with Schmee 150, actually. We lived together
that
period of time.
Huh.
Traveled to New Zealand, instructed together and stuff like that. But all that time I started taking photos, and I'd kind of been into photography, but not in like a... And then I think my engineering brain-esque has always been, how do I break that down? How do I do that better? How do I pick apart what someone's doing? Which actually seems to translate into being creative quite well in a sort of weird way. So taking lots of photos, started getting into photography, and then started making videos. And then this, along the time, realized I'd met a lot of people and had a reasonable amount of contacts that I thought at the beginning anyway, to start recording long form conversations. And for me, as I think the cars almost become less interesting over time because I'm exposed to more, I get to do more stuff. I love driving, but just looking at stats doesn't do so much for me anymore. It's about people and stories. And actually, that was a part of the podcast I didn't realize that I was going to enjoy at all. But now is the pretty much the only reason I do it, is I get to meet people like yourself that I wouldn't otherwise get to meet. We get to have a good chat and do these long form podcasts. It's not, here's your five questions and 5 minutes and you can prep them and send them back to me. And it's now, for me, it's about meeting the people and the experiences that I get to do it with. And this sort of enables
I think you're right, because that, what always strikes me about it is that you get social media saturates you with content. And if you like a certain type of content, you just get fed more and more of it. But it, for me, it is the driving that I enjoy more than anything else. So we bought, I've got a Seat Mii at home, like the VW up little thing, because my kids are learning to drive. And we bought that. And I really enjoy driving that. Again, it's that palate cleanser thing of a car that was designed, fundamentally interesting to me, a cars that are that fit for purpose for what they were designed to do. And that is true. And I think that a lot of the case nowadays is the brands are not doing that. They're doing cars that are, that they know will sell because they're fashionable or marketing led. So you get so many bloody crossovers and everything.
Yeah.
And yes, I can be impartial about them, but really I don't like them very much. But that Seat Mii, it's got 60 horsepower, but it does the job it was intended to do really well. And I think that's fundamentally what cars should be.
I think that's when my brain just hurts nowadays. Is it fit for purpose? And I used to be of the attitude, definitely with my own cars as well, was like, I kind of wanted each car to do everything and to be them all be able to suddenly take them on track and do whatever and just drive hardcore stuff all the time.
Yeah.
But now I've realized that's not the case. And you need, if you're going to have multiple cars, ideally they should do different things and they should be angled for that. But you do see brands moving away from where I personally go, but you do this so well and that's why people buy your cars. Like whether it's a Mini that's getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually people just buy a different car because it was designed. The reason people bought Minis in the first place was they were small-ish, you know, or crossovers, or whether it's luxury cars. I find a bit of a disconnect with Bentleys at the moment because I feel like they're not as comfy in luxury interior, everything amazing, but I don't think that they ride as well as my brain thinks they should. And then or these SUVs, DBX 707, which I hear is pretty good for what it is, setting Nürburgring lap times and stuff, like, couldn't care less. What are you talking about?
I think as soon as they try and broaden out a strategy, so they're trying to make sure their car is the ultimate on road and on track, then they're on a hiding to nothing, because you're not one thing nor the other there, and you've compromised all the way along the line to make a car that does both those things. When, you know, okay, there will be 10%, 15% of owners who will want to do both of those things, but you've you've fundamentally undermined yourself in a way by doing it. I think it's very rare to find. The Ferrari 296, I think, is a pretty exceptional bloody car, actually. I think that's really, really good. And the GT4 RS, those are the two cars that finished top in Speed Week. And I think what you were saying earlier about, you said, you know, if you could choose, would any of this year's cars come from a crop if you took the last decade, say? No, I think the 296 and the GT4 RS are all-time exceptional. I think they would be in any list of the best cars of the last decade. That GT4 RS especially, it might just be me, but yes, it was good on track, but it was just how it made you feel on the road, what it did on the road, and the noise it made, which was spectacular, I thought.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to hopefully having a go in one at some point. Mm. If you took the 296, and I've not driven one, lots of people, they reference something, whether it was like an F8 or a Pista or whatever, and go, yeah, but this is the best car currently for sale. And then you're like, oh, okay. But like, if we wound back a bit, people always go back to, let's say, a Speciale. Now, I know cars have actually moved on dynamically and what a lot since then. But your 296, and I know it's not the hardcore version, versus your Speciale, where do you sit?
I'd always just have the standard 296, I think. I know everyone gets excited about the racier ones. The 458 Speciale was pretty exceptional, actually. That was pretty exceptional. But talking about cars that are undervalued, standard 458s.
Yes.
I think they're, what, 110, something like that? And that's still a chunky chunk of money. But you're thinking, oh, electric's coming, and that engine has got one of the... That car's got one of the greatest engines ever in one of the greatest chassis ever as a standard pure sports supercar. A Boggo 458 is a bloody, bloody good thing.
Yeah, and I think they're coming back up again, and I don't know at some point whether they will start to overtake the more modern ones.
They might well do. I'd have a 458 over a 488 or an F8.
And I
any
think,
day of the week.
Yeah, before I don't want to talk forever and ever and ever, but on that bit of going, we as sort of, I don't even want to use the word petrol head anymore, because I think that's not the right word anymore, because it sort of implies that I'm anti-EV, and I quite like tech and EVs and stuff, so whatever. But when the sort of hardcore special versions of all these cars get sort of put on a plinth, and they are awesome, but that sort of fit for purpose thing of, is this, let's say you take your GT3 RS, maybe wind back to when you could have a manual, versus the GT3, which was a manual, the difference in the car, they are like a little bit better and a bit more raw and whatever, but they're not like 100% better. It's small percentages, and therefore the value in the slightly below, which delivers most of the experience, it makes much more sense to get one of them.
I think it does. I mean, you can even take that right back. I was fortunate enough to run a Boggo 911 Carrera for a few months, end of last year, early this year.
992.
And, 992. And I think if you want a daily 911, if you want a dirt 911, you're going to drive every day and do everything with, then a basic Carrera is absolutely all you need. And I could go beyond that and say it's actually the best Carrera, best 911 there is. It's going to be a weekend car, it's a GT3 all day long. But if it's a standard car that you're going to use as your daily car, you don't need an S, you don't need four-wheel drive, you don't need a GTS, you don't need a turbo. Just have the standard 911. Put some nice bits on it.
Yeah.
And that's done. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. But I know this is the one thing that I think separates motoring journalists from the actual people and shows how different we are sometimes to the people who actually buy the cars, is that we fundamentally will always go have a slightly purist mindset and go, no, this is all you need. And honestly, I would have a standard one over an S or a GTS, even if I had all three parked in front of me and told you can have any of those.
What?
But I think the buyer, when he goes to the dealership and is told this, you need this, or you want this, or you've got to have some one upmanship over your mates or whatever it is that the buying criteria is dictated by, I think that quickly goes out the window and they get
It is a really interesting one. And I'm in this situation right now, I'd say. It's a good situation to be in. But I have a 991.2 GTS that I use a lot of the time, PDK car, because I wanted adaptive cruise control, because I sit on motorways a lot. And annoyingly, you can't get a manual with adaptive cruise control. Anyway, I ordered a 992 GTS, but in February, and it's looking like it's not going to turn up. And I drove the GTS, and I really liked the 992, but now it's looking like it won't arrive. So I'm almost like resetting and going, well, what would I have off 992.2, which I think is not too far away. And I'm starting to, having now driven the GTS for my usage, I'm like, well, actually the 10 mil lower suspension, that's a bit stiffer, I don't want that. The power with all these cars now is enough. Like, doesn't matter. So maybe a Carrera, either manual or PDK, with just a few rear wheel steering, I think for me is one of the things you've got to have, especially around town and whatnot. And maybe a nice stereo or something. You save like 30 grand and you've got, I think I'll have a better car for the purpose.
Yeah. I completely agree. And in fact, the two things I'd say you don't need on a 911, this is through my process of having driven quite a lot of them, the standard stereo is really good, and the standard headlights, provided you can be bothered to flick the main beam on and off yourself, are amazing. You don't need anything else. This was some of my takeaways from driving a lot of them, is that, there's some good standard stuff on a 911 without having to go wild with the options.
Have you driven one with the acoustic glass in the windows? It's a really niche option. It's like £900.
Yeah, the double glazing on the sides. Yeah. I couldn't remember.
It's one of those ones I was searching for a car that had it spec'd to buy, and I couldn't find any 911 that had it. And I know one person that's got it on their turbo, and they're like, it's awesome. I think it's like 3 decibels quieter in the car. And you get a lot of road noise in those cars. So that is.
Yes, you do.
That's quite chunky.
But normally with 911s, it comes from the rear. So I don't know how much difference it makes, because it's usually sort of rear wheel arch liners that let the noise in. But the 992 is better for that, I think. They've made quite a big step with it.
Yeah. When do you drive 992.2?
I don't know. Well, I mean, you can work out the model schedule, so it's probably sometime in next year, I think, because I think this one came out 2019 or end of 18.
Yeah.
So it's usually on a 4-year model cycle. So
I think it's Geneva, wherever Geneva is this year, apparently. I think it's somewhere else. But I think it was about time to wrap this up. Thank you very much for coming on. It's been a
not at all, Sam. My pleasure. Good chat.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.